From the Land Grant University in Urbana-Champaign, Illinois, this is the Closing Mark Report. It's the fifth day of April 2010. I'm Todd Gleason. In a few moments, we'll talk about the commodity markets with Kurt Kimmel. He's the senior grains analyst at Bates Commodities in Normal, Illinois. And later in the half hour, we'll discuss the cash grain market with the folks at the Andersons right here in Champaign County. In agricultural news, Democrats are calling on the president to eliminate non-science barriers to free trade. And US EPA is coming under fire for going too far when looking to regulate pesticide drift. Dave Dickey will have details of these stories later in this half hour. And then in the second half hour of our program, that's right, I said the second half hour, at least on some of these radio stations, and online at willag.org for everybody, we'll talk with the president of the Renewable Fuels Association. His name is Bob Dineen. We call the second half hour the Farming World. In between the two, in just 26 minutes, we'll check in with the folks at Chesapeake Energy to discuss the global agricultural weather forecast. And that all happens right here on this Monday edition of the Closing Market Report. The Closing Market Report is a production of Illinois Public Media from the University of Illinois.
The Closing Market Report is made possible in part by a grant from Paul Cooley of ADM Investor Services in Oakland, Illinois, a full-service commodities firm with two toll-free lines. In Illinois, 800-252-2013. In Indiana, 800-637-3123. Or email to cooley at admworld.com.
In Chicago, on this Monday afternoon, futures finished the day like this. The nearby May wheat at 453.5, a penny and a quarter lower today. July, the harvest month at 467 and a quarter, down 1.25. September at 484, down 1 cent. May wheat futures in Kansas City, $4.71¾, a penny and three quarters lower. Back in the corn pit from Chicago, May corn 345¾, up 1¼. July at 357.5, a penny and a half higher. September at 367¾, up 1¾, and December futures at 379¼, up 2¼. March corn at 391¼, 2½ cents higher on the day. From the soybean pit nearby, May contract $9.36, down 6 cents today. July at 945¼, down 6. August at 941½, down 4¾. September at 928¼, down 4½. And November, 922¼, down 3½ cents. May bean meal at 261.20, down 470. July at 260.60, down 430. May soybean oil, 39.35, 37 higher for the day. April live cattle at 97.32½, up 67½. April feeders at 112.65, up 227½. And the April lean hogs at 76.22½, $2.10 higher. This is the Closing Market Report. Here's what the outside markets look like at this hour. Crude oil, May futures, $86.61, $1.74 higher. April ethanol at $1.51½, down 0.7 cents. Natural gas at $4.28¾, 19¢ higher for the day. Heating oil at $2.26¢, that's diesel fuel, up 4¢ a gallon. And the gold futures at $1,132.90 an ounce. Down, or rather up, $7.80. The Dow now stands at 10,974, just about 47 points higher. The U.S. dollar at 81.09 is down 0.20, and the CRB index at 279.51 is 3.08 higher on the afternoon. Here's what the weather forecast looks like for today, a more active weather pattern will develop this week, and widespread 1 to 2 inch rainfalls will occur. Temperatures, of course, will start the week well above average before a brief shot of much cooler air triggers a return of slightly above to near average temperatures for the end of the work week and this weekend. Windy conditions will accompany the arrival of cooler air by midweek. Calm conditions may develop briefly through the week, but generally, Illinois and Indiana will experience breezy winds for much of next week and the 10 days. Fields will remain too wet, of course, for any preparatory work, and flooding will remain a concern in low-lying areas and river basins, especially on southern and the western parts of our listening area in Illinois. We'll have a complete look at the agricultural weather forecast when we get closer to the bottom of the hour, and we talk with the folks at Chesapeake Energy in Chicago.
Support for WILL comes from Stuart Peterson, since 1985 offering strategic commodity consulting and marketing services to help producers manage market opportunities and risks by developing dynamic strategies customized to each client's goals and operation size. More information is at stuart-peterson.com.
Todd Gleason's services are made available to WILL by University of Illinois Extension.
You're listening to the Closing Mark Report as a production of Illinois Public Media on a Monday afternoon. I'm Todd Gleason. Kurt Kimmel of Bates Commodities out of Normal, Illinois, is on the line with us today to take a look at the agricultural futures markets. Good afternoon to you, Kurt.
Good afternoon, Todd.
Well, a Monday, a little rainfall over the weekend, and I'll bet farmers are thinking, boy, I wish I was in the field, and if I could be there, I would, but they're probably talking to you instead, what they have to say today.
Well, there was reports of some good activity up to yesterday there where we did receive some rain. A lot of little field work was accomplished. A lot of anhydrous went on. Some corn went in the ground. We heard north of Dwight and also a spot in southern Wisconsin and a spot in Iowa there. But as far as broad-based corn plantings, it's still a little early here for the upper Midwest to get too excited about it. We'll see how the weather unfolds, see how this week goes. But for the most part, with above normal temperatures last week and this week, first part of this week at least, we're going to see some opportunity, see the ground warm up, and see some activity pick up as we go. As far as forecast goes, some spotty isolated thunder showers are in the forecast. We'll see how the rain develops in the deep south where there's a little bit more aggressive activity. There was reports up to over an inch, which is going to slow them down for a day or two, Todd. So we're in the hands of the weatherman, and that's about like the commodity market. That changes about every couple hours also.
It changes every couple of hours. Has the direction been changing as of the last week or so based off what USDA released?
Well, what the USDA showed us is sort of confirmation that we have plenty of old crop stocks of corn and wheat around, and maybe a few more bean inventories than what the trade was looking for. Once we've seen this report now, it's sort of extended the corn trend in a downward type of trend here, and in the bean technical picture put us in a position to sort of test the lower end of support. So bean-wise, if you look at a bean chart and connect the dots or the lows, you can see this support line below the market. And I think the trade's going to be watching real close here and see when that trend line is taken out. Once that trend line is taken out, the trade's probably going to be a little bit more aggressive of putting in the short side, especially old crop beans.
Interestingly enough, that trend line still shows us an upside potential in the bean market, but we're riding down along that. Do you think that beans will come under pressure from a South American crop, enough of that, I suppose, that it will move lower below the trend line?
Well, longer term, that's going to keep a lid on the market, for say. Probably what's the more bearish concern would be the possibility or the prospects of a larger crop this fall more than anything. We've got two different markets, and when you look at the results of the crop report here at the end of the week, we're going to see a huge world supply, mainly due to the big South American production estimate, but a tight domestic supply here in the U.S. Stocks-to-use ratio is going to continue to be tight here in the U.S., 5-6%, and over 25% on the world supply-demand balance sheet. So we've sort of got two different markets, of course, with the big supplies in the Southern Hemisphere. That's going to offer more opportunity by beans cheaper out of the South America. So old crop beans are sort of going to follow here, for say, when there's needs for a crush here domestic, either meal side or oil side. That's going to give some hot basis every once in a while. But once that demand is satisfied, there's going to be limited buyers. So it's going to be an up and down trading affair. Once we get past the last round of numbers here this week from the reports, we'll mainly focus on weather. And that's going to move the bottom line more than anything, Todd.
Well, how bad would the weather have to get? How much of a delay do you think would really have to be in place to change the underlying fundamentals that have put the marketplace into a bearish tone?
Well, it depends whether you're a producer or a trader, for say. Right now, as far as weather goes, the mentality of the trader, for say, is that, you know, you'd have to see things stay wet clear into July, or come July, you have to be 110 degrees, because last year with the record late plantings and record late harvest, it's going to be hard to get the trade excited about too late of plantings at the present time. So the next big thing would be extremely warm and dry weather. It's going to take a little while for that to develop.
And tell me more about the corn market and how you see it laying out on the charts.
It's been in a downtrend here. We did see the market hold some downside objectives here. Technically, we're oversold, so we're due for good old-fashioned short covering bounce, dead cat bounce. You know, as far as a huge up move, you have to have reason to see the spec leaf trade come in and want to gain ownership. So we sort of view the trend as sideways or lower here. Seasonally, if you look at the long-term charts, seasonal charts, and plenty of guys have got some of those seasonal charts they could send to you, just ask for them. It clearly shows that the corn sort of rolls over here and trends lower through the month of April. However, the bean trade trend has been sideways to higher through the month of April.
I have a question about the dead cat bounce at this point. So when and if that were to happen and you had the bounce and you had corn in the bin that you needed to move, would you be a willing seller?
Each individual is different, which is our standard answer.
That's right.
But if you're heavily in a position where you've got quite a bit of old crop around, I would say, yes, you got to use 12-cent bounces in here to make some catch-up sales. We like holding 10, 20% into the summer from a cash, strictly cash side of the equation. We've always been that way and always will be that way. You know, if you don't have any sold or only half sold, we definitely would use, you know, 10, 15-cent bounces here to get caught up and transfer ownership to paper. There's some creative re-ownership ways where you can get a good chunk of your money in your pocket, then maintain ownership on paper for anywhere from 15 to 25 cents a bushel.
We appreciate you taking the time with us today.
Very good. Take care.
Hey, you too. That is Kurt Kimmel. He's with Bates Commodities out of Normal, Illinois. He joins us here on the Closing Mark Report. Happens each and every Monday afternoon.
Agricultural programs are made possible by First Midwest Bank, serving Illinois' agricultural community with locations in Champaign, Danville, Galesburg, Morris, and McHenry. More information is available from Tom Testel and Morris at 815-941-2184. First Midwest Bank, member FDIC, an equal housing lender.
You are listening to the Closing Mark Report. It's a production of Illinois Public Media. You can find us online at willag.org. And there you can sign up for our free weekend newsletter. And if you give us your cell phone number at that point, when those USDA reports come out, we'll text the numbers to you just after the report, maybe 10 or 15 minutes later. In fact, Dave Dickey will do that for you. He's here now with the news.
In agricultural news, the World Trade Organization dispute panel looking into China's complaint about some U.S. safeguard actions will deliver its ruling in June, according to David Walker, the chairman of the panel. At issue are decisions by the Bush administration to impose anti-dumping and countervailing duty orders on imports of Chinese steel pipes, tubes, tires, and woven sacks. Democratic members of the House Ways and Means Committee are calling on the Obama administration to request immediate negotiations on a host of trade problems. Among other things, the panel members want the Office of the U.S. Trade Representative to work to, quote, eliminate the most persistent and egregious barriers to trade, according to a letter sent to USTR Ron Kirk. The letter says that the major barriers to U.S. exports include non-science-based restrictions on U.S. pork, chicken, and beef imports, unfair competition in Japan's insurance market, and a series of barriers facing the U.S. automotive industry in key foreign markets. State pesticide regulators and ag industry groups say the Environmental Protection Agency has wafted a little too far off target in proposed regulations on pesticide spray drifts. Most current pesticide labels include the directions, quote, "Do not apply this product in a way that will contact workers or other persons, either directly or through drift." In its proposal, EPA would add a statement to those label directions. In addition, "Do not apply this product in a manner that results in spray or dust drift that could cause an adverse effect to people or any non-target organism or site." The National Association of State Departments of Agriculture and others are deeply concerned about the phrase "could cause adverse effects." Spokespeople for the NASDA say that few pesticides or pesticide applications would pass muster if a product or application had to have zero potential that it could cause any discernible adverse effect on health or on the environment. And that's a look at today's agricultural news.
Hey, thanks, Dave. Dave Dickey is Director of Agricultural Programming for Illinois Public Media. It's public radio for the farming world. By the way, that's the name of our brand new second half hour of this program, The Farming World. And our guest today is RFA's Bob Dineen on some of these radio stations. Everybody can hear it online at willag.org. Now, up next, you know the number of bushels of corn the livestock industry has consumed this marketing year is a bone of contention. I'll have a bit of explanation. End users, the ADMs and Cargills of the world, use the quarterly grain stocks report to backfigure some other numbers that aren't yet released by USDA, like the domestic feed and residual number. But there are some odd things happening in those figures this year, and while ag economist Darrell Good doesn't have a complete explanation, he thinks corn used for feed might be a different number than the trade expects.
If you look in the period 1999 through 2006, feed and residual disappearance during the first half of the marketing year was in a pretty narrow range as a percentage of the total for the year, averaged about 64%. The last 2 years, disappearance during the first half of the year has been extremely large, averaging 69%.
The question, then, is which seasonal pattern is feed usage following this year, and how does that impact the end-of-the-year stocks number for corn? It is a 400 million bushel question.
If first quarter use was 64% of the total for the year, then we're feeding corn at the rate very close to projected by the USDA, 5.55 billion bushels. If first quarter use was really 69% of the total, as it was the last 2 years, then we're feeding at a rate 400 million bushels less than currently projected by USDA. We don't know yet what is the seasonal pattern. We really won't get another peek at this until we get the June stocks number.
The market, says Darrell Good, is implicitly using the seasonal pattern from last year. Again, that number's 400 million bushels lower than the seasonal pattern the previous 7 years would suggest. He's unsure which scenario is the case this year, but does have an explanation, at least partially, for the difference in the percentage. It has to do with the increasing number of bushels of corn used to make ethanol.
As we're increasing over time, then year over year, the percentage increases are larger in the last half of the year than in the first half. So you're getting more distillers in the second half of the year, which then has substituted for corn. So that would line up with 07 and 08 pattern. But I'm hard-pressed for that to explain the entire shift in the seasonal pattern.
The difference will remain a mystery, says Good, until the June quarterly grain stocks report is released by USDA NASS. For University of Illinois Extension, I'm Todd Gleason.
Support for the Closing Market Report comes from AgriGold Hybrids, featuring the AgriGold Giants, a group of five new hybrids designed to meet the performance standards of yield, health, and consistency required by Midwestern corn growers. More information is at AgriGoldGiants.com or at 800-262-7333.
You're listening to the Closing Market Report from Illinois Public Media. It's a Monday afternoon. Jenny Springer is on the line with us from the Andersons right here in Champaign County to take a look at the cash grain market. Good afternoon to you, Jenny.
Good afternoon.
Tell me about this marketplace and whether farmers are thinking about hauling corn or soybeans into you at this time when they can't get into the field.
You know, it's one of those things where I don't think there's a lot of beans left out in the countryside that's not contracted in. And even then, I don't think that's very much. Corn, there is stuff moving. Guys are, you know, bringing stuff in that's on April contract that, you know, since they can't be in the field. However, some guys are starting to get, you know, in, putting some anhydrous on and doing minimal tillage right now in the, you know, lighter ground areas.
And what is basis acting like at this time?
Corn basis has some strength to it, and I think you'll see things get better, especially, you know, when we start getting into late spring, early summer, when, you know, corn's not moving as much because guys are in the field, and you start to see some premiums for number two yellow corn.
Are guys calling up and asking you very much about fall delivery and what their prospects might be?
You know, we haven't really had many guys asking about it, other than I think some guys that have some HTAs on the books are asking, you know, where our feeling on basis is going to be, and you know, whether it's a good time to lock it in or to wait.
Have you been talking amongst yourselves about differences regionally across the Midwest and where corn might be needed, where beans really will be needed in terms of end users?
Well, I think, you know, with the magnitude of beans that moved during harvest, that there's going to, you know, some processors in the areas are going to be needing beans come summertime. I think the biggest problem is going to be finding farmers that have beans on farm.
And your bids for the day are?
Cash corn, we are at 331. Fall corn, we are at 349. Cash beans, 926. Fall beans, 877.
Cindy, thanks so much.
Thanks.
Cindy Springer is with the Andersons. She joins us from their facility here in Champaign County. Somebody from that office comes along each and every Monday afternoon. If you'd like to hear what Cindy had to say again, you can always do it on our website. The address is willag.org. That's willag.org. There you'll find all of our daily ag programming. You can listen to it directly from the website. Sign up to have it delivered to your computer automatically as a podcast. Find the phone number to listen to it as voicemail at 217-333-3434. Sign up for our ag newsletter and a whole lot more. It's all at willag.org. Back in a couple minutes when we'll take a look at the agricultural weathercast.
It's National Raisin and Spice Bar Day. On this day in agricultural history in 1764, the Sugar Act passed in Britain, placing new restrictions on the import of molasses to America. In 1806, Isaac Quintard patented the apple cider mill. In 1858, W. Atlee Burpee was born. Burpee founded the world's largest mail-order seed company in 1876 when he was just 18 years old. He was staked by his mother, who gave him $1,000 to get started in his business. In 1881, Edwin Houston co-patented a centrifugal separator, which could be used in separating milk. By the way, the patent not only mentioned separating milk and cream, but clearing muddy water for paper making. In 1923, the Firestone Tire and Rubber Company of Akron, Ohio, began the first regular production of balloon tires for commercial use. Firestone's low-pressure balloon tires revolutionized work on the farm, giving tractors a more comfortable ride while lowering fuel consumption as well as lowering the danger of high-pressure tire blowouts. And that's this day in agricultural history.
Listening to the Closing Mark Report. It's a production of Illinois Public Media. On a Monday afternoon, time to check the agricultural weather forecast. Josh Darr of Chesapeake Energy joins us from the Chicago skyline. Good afternoon to Josh. And first, thanks so much for being with us on Commodity Week over the weekend.
Hey, no problem. It's my pleasure, Todd.
Has anything changed in our weather picture since then?
Well, a little bit. We have this rain opportunity out ahead of us, and actually Springfield on the hour here, Springfield, Illinois, having a thunderstorm, and thunderstorms breaking out across southern Iowa. That's the start of several days of rainfall here across the central portions of the Midwest. And really, that's our only rainfall opportunity until the middle of next week. We come into another period of dry weather beyond Wednesday, and that extends pretty much through next Wednesday when you start to get activity in the western corn and bean belt, mainly eastern Nebraska, western Iowa, in the middle of next week, and then that slowly pushes further east after there. So from where we left things late last week with Commodity Week, interestingly, it looks like the pattern is still drier maybe than we thought late last week and warmer as we work through the middle portion of April.
It will be good news for producers as subsoil moistures are still pretty wet.
They are. They are indeed. So the topsoil gets a drink here, and then you dry out for 7 days. And with the drying out we had occur over the weekend with the well above normal temperatures, 20-25 degrees above normal this past weekend, things should dry out nicely here for planting, which certainly commences in earnest next week with the insurance.
Yeah, tell me a bit about the Southwest and Southeast and how they've been able to proceed or not proceed in the early growing season.
They've proceeded pretty nicely, actually. There has been a lack of activity after a very stormy pattern in February and early March. We've dried out here, and really with this troughing out in the western part of the U.S., it's set up southerly flow, strong winds. We've had great drying down conditions, which have allowed for, active fieldwork prep and planting, early planting here southeast, southwest.
If you take a look around the rest of the globe, what do you see for the South American harvest as they move into the latter part of that program?
Things continue to look great there. No extended wet patterns developing across Brazil through middle of April. Argentina is dry this week. Next chance for rain is in the early portions of next week, but it looks like a rather minor event. And the only other place we're really monitoring here is China. Northern China looks to be colder than normal for the next 10 days to 2 weeks. And you start to think a little bit about, does that push back planting in the northern China belt?
Are they wet as well?
They will be dry. They're dry here at least this week. They have been wet prior to this week. So it's that cool, damp scenario that we've seen here in the Midwest the past couple years, not this year so far. In the far northern China belt.
And then maybe we better take up some of the wheat-growing regions. It was very, very warm in New Delhi last week.
Mm-hmm.
And will they continue that?
The excessive level of heat they saw last week with temperatures daily over 100 degrees Fahrenheit looks to back off a little bit here, and you'd be more in the mid-90s, which is still above normal for this time of year, but not the excessive heat as we move through the next 10 days. And so any stress that could have resulted from that 100-105 degree heat, which is usually in the middle of June, should be on the waning side of things.
Josh, thank you so much.
Thanks, Todd.
Hey, Josh Darr is with Chesapeake Energy in Chicago, Illinois, and joins us here on the Closing Mark Report. That happens each and every Monday afternoon. We'll say so long to a few of our radio stations. The rest of you will be with us in a moment. We'll talk with Bob Dineen of the RFA.
Support for the Closing Market Report comes from AgriGold Hybrids, featuring the AgriGold Giants, a group of five new hybrids designed to meet the performance standards of yield, health, and consistency required by Midwestern corn growers. More information is at AgriGoldGiants.com or at 800-262-7333.
I'm Todd Gleason. You're listening to Illinois Public Media. Of course, it is a production of the University of Illinois. We're on the phone today with Bob Dineen. He's the president and CEO of the Renewable Fuels Association and is based in Washington, D.C. Thanks so much for joining us today, Bob. How are you?
I am terrific, Todd. Good to be with you.
Well, let's talk about the Renewable Fuels Association. Some of our audience, of course, will be very familiar with the RFA and what it does and what it promotes in the world of ethanol, but some of them will not. Can you tell us, please?
Sure. The Renewable Fuels Association is the national trade association that represents the U.S. ethanol industry. Our membership includes producers, but also suppliers to the industry, and we work in Washington, D.C. to assure that there is strong public policy support that will allow the industry to continue to grow and develop.
How long has it been around?
The RFA has been around for almost 30 years now, and we've seen a great deal of growth over that time, so it's been pretty exciting. I've been with the RFA myself for 22 of those 30 years. So I've seen an awful lot of change within this industry.
And for those who'd like to learn more about it, they can always visit you online. That's probably pretty easy to do at ethanolrfa.org.
Absolutely. Thank you.
Well, I have it in front of me. And so we've got many questions to start out with. Let's talk about the policy things in the very beginning of the RFA, some 30 years ago, the late 80s, when ethanol was a small industry, relatively speaking, located primarily in Decatur, Illinois. What were the types of things that the RFA was pushing, and what have you achieved over the three decades?
Well, when ethanol first started out as a small industry, it was, of course, focused on trying to reduce our dependence on imported oil, and there were a lot of small gasoline marketers that were using our products early on, and they would blend ethanol in order to add octane, extend fuel supplies, and actually be able to compete cost-effectively with their major refiners, who were also their competitors in the marketplace, but their suppliers as well. What was really important in the early days of the industry was a tax incentive that refiners and gasoline marketers would claim. And that tax incentive allowed the gasoline marketers to offer ethanol blended fuels to the consumers quite cost effectively. As ethanol gained in public acceptance, people began to realize that it was actually reducing emissions. And in 1990, the Congress, for the very first time, actually required gasoline marketers and refiners to reduce emissions from their product, and required a reformulated gasoline program that had with it an oxygen requirement associated with it, and that prompted some significant growth in ethanol as well. At the time, though, Todd, there were really two oxygenates that were being used. Ethanol was one, but MTBE was another. And MTBE, methyl tertiary butyl ether, was a petroleum-derived oxygenate that did everything that ethanol did. It just had this one problem. When it was in gasoline, it would find its way to water supplies. And so by the late 1990s, when people began to see MTBE showing up in their water, like Kankakee, Illinois, there was an effort to remove MTBE from gasoline. And it was really those actions in the late 1990s that took this industry from 1 billion gallons or 2 billion gallons of production to where we're seeing it today. We will this year produce some 12 billion gallons of ethanol, and it was because refiners, you know, really have to use ethanol in their reform of the gasoline programs to reduce emissions, but now as well as a result of legislation that was passed just a few years ago, the renewable fuel standard that required refiners to utilize us. So over the span of 20 years, you saw ethanol being used as a gasoline extender, then as a means of reducing emissions, and over the last several years, as a way for refiners to meet the renewable fuel standard that allows ethanol to be blended and other biofuels to be blended in gasoline, and has really resulted in significant growth in the industry.
The ethanol industry has always talked about themselves as energy security for the United States. Was 9/11 a seminal event in the political landscape that allowed ethanol to grow to its current size?
Well, that's an astute observation, Todd, because, you know, we had been trying as an industry, working with some in the environmental community and others, to create a renewable fuel standard around the beginning of 2000-2001. But when that horrible event occurred, it certainly did crystallize for members of Congress the very real impact of our dependency on imported oil on that part of the world with regimes that didn't like us very much. And there was renewed effort to get more domestic renewable fuels like ethanol into the marketplace that eventually resulted in the renewable fuel standard being passed in 2005. But clearly, the energy security issue has been one that has resonated on the Hill and also resonates with the public, because I think people do recognize that we need to reduce our dependence on imported petroleum if we are ever truly going to be secure as a nation.
Nearly a decade out, not quite that far from that event, has the political will to continue to use alternative energy sources begun to wane yet or not?
No, it really hasn't. What you've seen is the success of the renewable fuel standard that was passed in 2005. And initially, it required 7.5 billion gallons of ethanol to be produced. And there was a lot of talk at the time, oh, the ethanol industry will never be able to grow to meet that much demand. And, you know, what an aggressive target that was. But within a couple of years, we had demonstrated not only we could produce that much, but we could likely produce far more. And so even by 2007, the Congress then expanded that program to be just not a 7.5 billion gallon requirement, but a 36 billion gallon requirement, and also targeted that growth for continued evolution in the industry, so that we're not just producing from grain, we might also be producing from cellulosic materials, things like municipal solid waste or woody biomass or corn cobs or agricultural residues, but other materials that will just greatly expand the feedstocks that we're able to utilize in the production of a domestic renewable fuel. And that program also has been extraordinarily successful, and you've seen the industry continue to grow. As I said, this year we will produce more than 12 billion gallons of ethanol. And, you know, there are a number of companies that are today looking at producing ethanol from a variety of feedstocks. And we're confident we're going to get to that 36 billion gallon number by 2022, which is what the statute requires. This administration, like the previous one, has continued the focus on the evolution of the industry, moving us to new feedstocks, to more carbon-sensitive technologies. And it's truly a very exciting time in the industry.
In the March issue of Ethanol Producer Magazine, and I think you write probably for each issue, it's a monthly magazine, a commentary, mm-hmm. you write an article called View from the Hill. In the March issue, you titled The Ethanol Decade Redo. And one of the paragraphs reads about the things that maybe you think need yet to be done or still to be done in Washington, D.C. And you write extending the tax incentives for ethanol blending, increasing the blending wall, implementing and defending the renewable fuel standard, and formulating a fair national low-carbon fuels policy are all necessary for the industry to succeed. Maybe we can take those up in order and start with extending the tax incentives. Why is it necessary to continue to do that when it appears that the ethanol industry, at least at this point, has a pretty good footing across at least the Midwest?
Well, we do have a good footing, and it is because of the foundation of public policy support that encourages refiners to blend our product because, you know, left to their own devices, oil companies wouldn't necessarily want to use a product that they don't produce and that they don't control, and they'd be happy enough just continuing the nation's dependence on petroleum and, you know, even imported petroleum. The tax incentive has always been the very foundation of the public policy program. It allows gasoline marketers to purchase our product and compete with major refiners. It allows our industry to innovate, to seek new technologies. It will allow the continued evolution of the industry to go on. And in the absence of the tax incentive, our analysis would show that you would likely lose approximately 38% of domestic production. And we would have to import greater supplies of foreign-produced ethanol that is subsidized in order to compete, and would lose perhaps as many as 112,000 jobs. So, you know, the tax incentive is going to continue to be extraordinarily important to the continued growth and development of the industry. You know, at some point, we all want the federal involvement in the ethanol industry to cease. But right now, with energy being so highly subsidized across the globe, not just in this country, and with the oil industry continuing to get a number of subsidies and support from the government, there's not a level playing field. And so the government needs to make choices in order to have the kind of energy that is going to promote rural economic development, promote environmental stewardship, promote energy security. And so the tax incentive is going to help to do that. It is one that has paid for itself in terms of reducing farm program costs, increasing tax revenues, creating jobs, lowering our dependence. I believe that the federal ethanol tax incentive is one of the most successful programs that has been created by Washington. It has done everything that Congress has wanted it to do in terms of building an important industry, creating jobs, creating rural economic development opportunities, and I believe it needs to be extended.
We're talking this afternoon with Bob Dineen. He is the CEO and president of the Renewable Fuels Association. More with him when we return.
Agricultural information is made possible with support from ADM. ADM thanks America's farmers because everything they do starts with you.
In business news, a Chinese government economist today says that the U.S. decision to delay a contentious currency report did not mean Beijing will change the value of its currency anytime soon. U.S. Treasury Secretary Timothy Geithner on Saturday postponed a report due out on April 15th that could have branded China a currency manipulator. Geithner says that he will use meetings of the Group of 20 and a U.S.-China strategic dialogue in Beijing in May to urge China to budge on the yuan. Several Chinese economists quoted in the overseas edition of the People's Daily, the official newspaper of China's ruling Communist Party, maintained that the yuan was not to blame for the U.S. trade deficit. U.S. crude oil futures hit an 18-month high today, climbing toward $86 per barrel on expectations of faster-than-expected economic recovery and increasing demand for fuel. Data on Friday showed U.S. employers created jobs in March at the fastest rate in 3 years. Technical analysts have become more bullish and suggest that the oil market could move higher in the next few weeks. Buoyed by good news on the jobs front, the White House claimed credit Sunday for reversing the downward economic spiral while bracing out-of-work Americans for a slow recovery. Lawrence Summers, director of the National Economic Council, says, quote, "We've inherited a terrible situation, the most pressing economic problems since the Great Depression in our country. We've got a long way to go." And that's a look at today's business news.
Agricultural programming is made possible by Farm Credit Services of Illinois. Farm Credit Services of Illinois has been providing for farmers' credit and insurance needs for over 90 years, including real estate, operating and machinery loans, crop and life insurance protection, and programs for young and beginning farmers.
I'm Todd Gleason from University of Illinois Extension. This program is a production of Illinois Public Media. Today we're talking with the CEO and president of the RFA, the Renewable Fuels Association. His name is Bob Dineen. Bob, thanks so much for continuing our conversation. When we left, we were talking about some of the things that were on your plate as president of the RFA and what you would like to have continue, at least as policies in Washington, D.C. Extending the tax incentive is one of those things. How big is that tax incentive, and in what forms does it take?
Well, refiners and gasoline marketers that blend ethanol are given a 45-cent tax advantage, an excise tax exemption. That has encouraged them to blend ethanol and build this industry.
Can you turn your attention to one of the next things on the list? And we hear a lot about this in the world of agriculture. It's called the blend wall. Can you tell me what it is?
Sure. In the 1980s, when ethanol was just a blip on the U.S. energy scene, EPA had limited the amount of ethanol that could be blended into a gallon of gasoline to 10% per gallon. Now, at the time, you know, that seemed just fine. At the time, you know, ethanol was only being blended in a few states in the Midwest, and being 10% of the nation's motor transportation fuel seemed to be a target that we would never reach. But with the growth in the ethanol industry, with policies like the tax incentive and the renewable fuel standard, we are now at the point where ethanol is blended in 90% of the nation's motor fuel at 10% per volume in each gallon of gasoline. And we are nearing the point where you're not going to be able to blend more ethanol into gasoline unless EPA increases the limitation on how much ethanol can be blended into every gallon. And we have petitioned EPA to lift that somewhat arbitrary limitation. In other parts of the globe, in Brazil, for example, every single gallon of gasoline is blended with 25% ethanol. And the vehicles in Brazil, although may be slightly different in terms of some of their emissions controls, they are largely the same as the vehicles sold here, and they are produced by companies like General Motors and Ford and Toyota, and other companies that sell vehicles here as well. So we don't believe that there is a technical barrier to how much ethanol you could add into gasoline. There is a political barrier. And we hope that sometime over the course of this summer, the Environmental Protection Agency will evaluate all of the data that has been submitted and recognize that E15 is certainly well within the bounds of what is technically feasible in today's technology, and lift that limitation and allow the ethanol industry to continue to grow.
Do you think that the automobiles, most of them in the United States, can manage a blend at E15?
I have absolutely no doubt that automobiles on the road today would be able to utilize E15 without any difficulty whatsoever. Again, this really is not a technical challenge. It is a political challenge.
And finally, last question. I understand how probably corn farmers in the industry would benefit. What benefit is there to the consumer?
Oh, there's a huge benefit to the consumer. The very fact that ethanol is now such a significant part of the total U.S. motor fuel market, we are helping to reduce consumer gasoline costs significantly. A study that was done by Morgan Stanley a bit more than a year ago now said that the global supply of ethanol, as it is growing so rapidly, was actually helping to reduce crude oil prices by as much as 15%. That translates into savings at the gasoline pump of as much as 50 cents a gallon at times. And if you were to take that amount of ethanol away, and we would have to find that much more imported petroleum to make up for the lost ethanol, the impact on consumer gasoline prices would be substantial. You know, think about it in this country. Anytime there is a hiccup in the refining or distribution of gasoline, prices go through the roof. Consumers in Illinois see it frequently when a refiner will go down and production is reduced. You'll see spikes in gasoline prices. Well, those spikes would happen permanently were ethanol not to be such an important part of the U.S. motor transportation system.
Mr. Dineen, thank you so much for joining us today. We do appreciate it.
Todd, thank you very much.
Bob Dineen is the president and CEO of the Renewable Fuels Association. You can find more online at ethanolrfa.org. This program is a production of Illinois Public Media. You have a good afternoon. I'm Todd Gleason.